Now, Ridley, before you ever made a real movie, you had a long and successful career directing commercials.
Oh, yeah, but I'll show you stuff from 25 years ago and knock your socks off, which are real storytelling filmlets. And that went on for actually longer than I care to imagine, to the extent that I almost forgot about doing feature films because I was enjoying myself so much.
Well, something that you made, like sort of like a little feature film that I assume is your most famous television commercial 21 years ago, was the 1984 commercial for Apple, which I'd love to play a little bit of, and then you can
Sure.
tell me about it.
Okay.
We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause. Our enemies shall talk themselves to death, and we will bury them with their own confusion. We shall prevail.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
See, that's a good ad, right? In terms of launching what would be the domestic computer, right? Now, I can't even switch on a computer because, unfortunately, when you've got lots of people to do it for you, you actually become illiterate in that process because everybody says, get your hands off the keyboard, I'll do it, right?
Right.
So I still function with a piece of paper, a pad, and pens because I can draw like a son of a bitch. And I still say, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words when you're making movies. But the Jobs computer was beautiful. When I saw it, I thought, wow, this is, looks spectacular. But who the hell is going to pay $2,500 for this thing so that you can do the grocery list at home? I was wrong, wasn't I?
I guess so. You mentioned your skill at drawing. I know you spent several years at art school and then as a designer in television. Did learning the nuts and bolts of the craft help you as a director?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like learning to paint. You know, you better, the teacher always used to say, here's an apple on a plate, draw it, you know. And if you, until you can draw that, don't start to try and even paint it. And I'm a great believer in the idea of apprenticeship and craftsmanship. I think there's the 60s in a funny kind of way. I know I sound like a spoil sport, but the 60s took a lot of that idea and idealism, a way of you got to work for it. You got to show what you can do before someone just hands you the job. And then there was this big thing about the youth in the 60s, and the amount of chaos that came out of the 60s was, some people will argue it was great. All I remember was working like a dog and out of it, but suddenly it was very, very, very successful in advertising.
So you went from art school to working in advertising and were making advertising films pretty immediately in that role?
I think I was an animal, actually, because I was at art school for 7 years, and I was all over everything. I was on the printing press, typesetting, taking huge lithographic stones and grinding them, making lithographic four-print masters. I was painting pottery, ceramics, life drawing, and then general studies. And I loved every minute. So it was almost like predetermined I'd get in the Royal College. Got in the Royal College. At the end of it, I got a first-class honors Royal College, and they gave me a traveling scholarship. So I was then in design, full-board design mode. And they said, where do you want to go? And I said, New York, no question, mate. I got into New York, and because no one was watching over me, I had to stay in the YMCA because there had no money. The grant was, you know, tiny. They always thought it was a lot of money. It was nothing. But I decided I wanted to be a filmmaker. As I arrived in New York, I said, I love design. I'll use it. I've learned everything about photography. I will use it. But I want to be a director, and I do not want to be a designer. So I found out where Don Pennybaker and Richard Leacock worked.
The great documentary makers.
Yeah, off 42nd Street. And I then stood in the lobby with my portfolio on 3 mornings running, and I don't think they'll ever know this, until I saw two guys walk in, and one said to the other one, Don, and the other one said, Dick. And I thought, this got to be it. So I walked in the elevator with them. By the time I got the fourth floor, I had a job.
Now, you were a very successful commercial television commercial maker. You could have stayed in that profession. How, as you went through your 20s and then 30s, did you nurture your own ambition to make not only feature films, but great feature films that weren't just hack work? I mean, lots of people would have said at a certain point at 35, ah, I got a life, I have a mortgage, I have kids, I'll just keep making commercials.
Oh, no, you can't do that. I mean, I think it's a natural evolution that you have to do. I felt I had to do long form, and I wrote three screenplays, and funnily, I've nearly got one made. It was called Ronnie and Leo, and it was a heist thing, two buddies, and I thought, this is it. The die was cast, the gloves, the gauntlets on the ground, and the scent was there. I now had to do a movie.
Now, your only well-known movie before Alien was a small period piece, the Napoleonic drama called The Duelist. I wondered how that convinced Hollywood studio executives to hire you to direct this huge science fiction adventure.
God knows, because I got a call in London from somebody saying, at Fox, funny enough, we've got this script called Alien. We're going to send it. Would you like to? Because my agent, there was a guy who said, you want to read this science fiction? And I'd seen Star Wars. And I had saw Star Wars. George Lucas directed the first Star Wars. That knocked my socks off. That was, for me, seminal.
Yep.
I then got a call, Alien. I thought, curious title. I went over, met the boys. In a nutshell, I said, I'll do it. Do you want to change anything? Nope. What do you think? I love it. And we talked about the hardest, most difficult thing of all to do that film successfully was what was the beast going to be like? Because I'm pretty sophisticated at this point as a commercial maker, and I know this beast. I've always looked at screen horrors prior to this, and there'd only been two, honestly. The best film to this date that scared the living daylights out of me was The Exorcist, number one, which I thought was brilliant. Then I'd also seen Toby Hooper's film that nearly made my hair stand on end called Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That was a brute. And to the extent that you felt, halfway through, I'm going to leave now, but then you felt it wasn't macho, you should not leave, you've got to stick it out. And I thought, I can't do this. I got to make a film like that. So the toughest thing was, what's the beast going to be?
And you don't see the monster very much in that film, actually.
But isn't that the trick?
Absolutely.
It's like Jaws. Don't show it too often.
Oh, God, it's moving right towards you. Move, get out of there. What are they doing? Move!
You let the audience's mind work. Let them drive their own goddamn paranoia. And by the way, you do see a lot. You see a great egg. You see the innards of the egg. You see a face burster, which comes out of the egg and lands on a mask and does something obscene. You then see a chest burster, and then you see the big boy. So you see quite a lot. People say you don't see much of the alien. I say, wait a minute, the alien is from the alien spacecraft, through the egg, through the thing that comes out of the egg, right through to the chest burst. To me, was a pretty tough scene.
That was when it comes out of John.
Yeah. That people used to go catatonic at that moment because I think they couldn't believe. I used to stand on the edge and watch the audience because by this juncture I was so bored. With cutting it, and so I'd stand on the edge and watch. And I used to get great glee out of seeing, because once the thing came out of the egg, the audience had that horrible feeling that maybe we should go now, right? And then you knew you were in trouble, and certainly you knew they were in trouble on the ship. And when you get true scary things happen in cinema, you have this awful feeling about a minute before something really terrible is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always this predetermined look of dread, which always used to amuse the hell out of me. And then it would come out of the chest. And what's great is the whole cinema was like a little bunch of little heads that all pop together all in unison. It's funny.
So Alien was your first huge Hollywood movie, first huge success. And it seems to me it began your series of successes at kind of reinventing a genre. It was certainly at the time of Star Wars, which that was, it was a very, very different vision of what science fiction could be.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Stan Lee had done that. Kubrick did that with 2001.
Right.
I mean, and yes, there were good science fiction films, of course, prior to that, which had entertained me. But I'd always regarded them as entertainment with a little bit of tongue-in-cheek and thought, well, it was okay. And on the effect, the spaceship looked okay. You know, and the monster was not bad. But was I afraid? Nah. You know, was I really impressed? Not really. Stanley did 2001. That was it. I mean, I thought, this is real. This is future. What a genius idea that the main protagonist is a computer that becomes either misguided or paranoid. And I thought it was great humor in the whole thing, and I just thought it was absolutely magical.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Even to the extent of towards the end, I still don't know what Stanley means by the ending, but I sat there enchanted. I've seen it 8 times, so I always have a different story about what he meant at the end.
You mentioned the powerful, hyper-realistic quality of Stanley Kubrick's 2001. I'd use the same words to describe your follow-up to Alien, Blade Runner, which came out in 1982. How did you develop that amazing vision of this dark, industrial, dirty, crowded future? Did it just come full-blown, straight out of your head?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'd been doing commercials. Remember, I'd been doing commercials in Hong Kong, Kowloon, 10 years prior. I was doing commercials in Hong Kong 40 years ago. That's when it was really seriously impressive.
So the Hong Kongishness of that Blade Runner milieu you came by honestly.
That's it. I mean, that was it. I always thought I wanted to make the film in Hong Kong. And they said, yeah, out of your mind, because Hong Kong is not what it is today. And in Hong Kong, in the harbor, you could have 2,000 junks, you know? And you literally cross the decks at twilight and you're walking into the 19th century with families sitting, eating on little burners on the deck and they're cooking. And you can cross them deck to deck as they would all anchored together. It was like an armada because these junks were 3 stories at the back end. These are like galleons. And then on the streets, I'd walk on the streets with the smells of Hong Kong, which would range from obvious sewage to they cook with banana oil. So you never forget that combination of banana oil and this sewage. They'll forgive me, but that's what it was. If you fell in the harbor, forget it, mate. You may as well just stay under. You don't ever come up.
So all of that came into, converged and informed that dense, oily, rainy streets of Blade Runner that people
loved. They'd just invented polystyrene for packing, and everything would go in the harbor. So the polystyrene, there'd be a crust around the boats of polystyrene, like 2 or 3 feet thick, just bobbing up and down. And everything went in the harbor. It was unbelievable. It was the most impressive density future shock I've ever seen.
So you looked at that and thought, this is the future of a kind.
Oh, yeah.
Let's listen to actually a clip from Blade Runner in which we hear the head of the renegade replicant band played by Rutger Hauer speaking.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears in rain.
That's Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. I'm talking to Ridley Scott today. The film that I saw back in 1982 and loved very much is actually quite different from the movie The Blade Runner that I saw recently on DVD.
The only difference, honestly, was voiceover in 82. And at the ending, I'd done such a weird world that, I thought I got it right. And I thought it was, I hadn't even thought that it was in any shape or form kind of visionary. I just thought it was correct for the story. Mm. And I thought I'd really nailed it. And kept getting, the worst thing about audience research is that it can unravel everything. Mm. It is very destructive force. And breeding insecurity. So you're vulnerable at that moment. And the guys that were around me, the producers, were saying, they said, God damn, it's such a depressing movie and such a depressing ending. And I kept saying, but it's a film noir, for God's sake. It's a Philip Marlowe. Mm-hmm. And he's not in Miami. He's in the future. And nevertheless, then the audience started to say, oh, it's so depressing, And he said, you got to have a happy ending. So I thought, maybe they're right. So the version you see is the digital version. I went back and thought, nope, it should go back to what it was. Take off the voiceover. Let them work it out as the film evolves. Let them work out what city speak means as the film evolves. Somebody said to me once when you get God, the guy who plays the cops, Hispanic cop, mm-hmm. Says, too bad she won't live, but then who does? Somebody says, what does that mean? I said, do you really want me to explain? That's a truism, mate. What do you mean? I said, I'm not even going to go any further. That's when I knew I was really in trouble.
When you were getting notes on rhetorical questions?
Oh, yeah. And so I thought, oh, please. Okay. So we removed in the digital the happy ending. And just for the hell of it, the original ending, I'd actually talked to Stanley Kubrick because he'd done The Shining. I knew there has to be helicopter footage somewhere of this magnificent Montana.
Where he shot The Shining?
Yeah, and the exteriors. I called him saying, Stan, I need to help. I've had a disastrous series of previews. I've got to find a happy ending. I've got to preview one more time. I know you have got a shot, Montana from, end to end. He said, that's true. I said, in helicopter, that's true. Can I borrow two or three shots because I want to show a happy ending going off into the wilderness? So he says, yeah, okay. Within a day, I had 6 weeks of helicopter footage, which I then plowed through. Then I get a phone call saying, listen, if this gets further, he said, you cannot use any shot I've used in the movie. He said, but if you really want it, well, let's talk about it. And he basically gave me the footage I needed.
And the end of Blade Runner that was released in theaters is Stanley Kubrick's shot from The Shining. The DVD and the emergence of DVDs has certainly helped the influence and durability of that film because it's such a cult hit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you now, when you're shooting movies, when you were shooting Kingdom of Heaven, shoot with the idea of, oh, I've got to have all these extra bits on a DVD?
No. You still shoot the play. You still try and get the play right, and then at the end you look at it during the editing process and go, maybe the play's too long. Next year I could have a version of Kingdom of Heaven that could run another hour. And it's not just expanding scenes and things. It's other material. So, at the time, they'll say, well, why did you shoot it if you knew you weren't going to use it? The answer is I didn't know I was going to use it. I still believe I can stick an ostrich egg into an egg cup.
Sir Ridley Scott, I thank you very much for joining us today in Studio 360.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ridley Scott's new film, Kingdom of Heaven, is out in theaters right now. To find out more about him and all his films, visit our website, studio360.org.